as we begin, I'd like you to think about all the important things that have to do with women in the world. And to consider that this is much better than $45 worth, really, as you are looking at what I have to offer you this morning. As we are moving into the world of the pinks of sports. My teaching aids are all about you, and I wish you to examine them in your own time. In the meantime, what we are going to do today is to talk a little bit about the significance that I was born in pink. My brother was born in blue. And that's my touch of blue, with the exception of my tomboy shirt, which we'll look at a little bit later. As you can see, I am properly attired so that you have no question of my identity. I don't want to have any identity crisis. I want you to know that I am in pink because it's terribly significant that I stand around in my pink attire in case I have any masculine characteristics that might make you doubt my femininity. So I wear my pinks as I meet my classes because I teach a course in sport for Americans, male and female. And I teach a lot of football players in my Men in Sport and What is the Meaning of It course, and an advanced course in philosophy of sport. And so it's terribly significant that they know that I wear rings and that usually I have clean fingernails, not when I hike. Usually I have clean toenails. Never, however, will I move to what all women tend to do sometime in their lives, and that is to wear the high heels. And they are coming back into the world. So what makes us deal in this kind of pink and blue world? It is not from you or from me or from our immediate parents, perhaps even our grandparents, but it probably goes back a lot farther than that in terms of who we are and what we think about ourselves. So I thought what we could do to start out today is to talk about all the ways in which we tend to think this is female, this is the separate sphere for women, and for what is the sphere of men, we all know. So what we're going to talk about is the sphere of women. Partly because in the world of health, there has been very little said that isn't myth. In what is it that makes a healthy woman? How does a woman become healthy? How does a woman stay healthy? Particularly in a world in which in the past, the ideal was a cult of true womanhood. Now, when I say cult of true womanhood, what is garnered up in your minds? From the Victorian world, from all worlds.
I was going to say, when I helped the first grade, I was an assistant in the first grade, we had one girl whose mother wouldn't let her play on the playground. She always wore dresses, everybody else wore rompers or slacks, but she had to sit during PE because her mother wouldn't let her. We had play day, she had to sit and watch. She couldn't play. And I know her mother thought that was the ultimate feminine thing to do.
Is that an unusual story from the past?
I could never play baseball, and I love baseball.
We played basketball half a floor, because if you ran the whole length, you'd injure yourself.
Yes, that's a wonderful start. Yes, who invented that game of half-court women's basketball?
Man.
A woman?
My foremothers. In 1899, a group of physical education women met together because the game of basketball, which they began playing in 1892, 1 year after the men did, was simply too rough, unladylike, individualistic, probably took too much energy, masculine, and it simply was a game for men, not a game for women. So in their infinite wisdom,
based on that we are products of our culture. They developed the present game of basketball. Actually, they developed a three-court division of the court. They took away any kind of tying the ball. Those of you who played basketball, why would they do that? I own this ball. What right have you to slap it out of my hand? But the next one's a little harder. I can't dribble the ball. Why can't I dribble the ball? Interesting.
Physiologically, women are supposed to be different from men.
One of the problems is they do not look good. But even before that, the women had a much more wholesome reason. And it has to do with why we are so different in the kinds of people we are. How are we different as people in our stereotyping of women? Besides physiological.
Smarter.
We are smarter, we know now. Like Norm Nagel, if any of you know him, suggested one day in his final argument after about 4 hours with me, well, have you ever seen a woman win the national and international chess championship? Answering himself, of course not. Finally, I say to myself, I look it up. Guess why?
They're not allowed.
They were not allowed in the competition. So, of course, with that, Norman changed that one bit of stereotyping that he lived with, at least temporarily in my presence. What else was true in the past of how we stereotyped women?
That would control emotionally.
Emotionally out of control. Emotionally, can we be individuals?
Great difficulty.
Our whole world of the cult of true womanhood is submissiveness, is it not?
And all women are the same.
And all women are the same. Why then can't I dribble this ball all the way down the court and shoot? I did it. I started from this end, and I went all the way down to that end, and I made a basket.
That doesn't make you very submissive.
It's not team play.
It's not team play. And we have to have team play for women, for our health. Heaven forbid for bonding, because we didn't know what bonding was. Not for networking, because we didn't know what networking was. But it individualized us, and it made us an individual. And that's not what life for women is all about. So we cannot dribble. That later a few women invented, okay, I'll bounce it once and let it run along the floor and pick it up. I can tell you're in my age more than in others. And so we developed the game of women's basketball because physical educators were a separate sphere of women. It's one of the reasons, actually, that I'm able to stand before you today in my great independence, in my singleness, and in a commanding sort of presentation. Because I lived for most of my life professionally in a separate world of women. A world in which I was autonomy. And if I decided, along with my sisters, that we wanted to play field hockey, which incidentally is 100 yards up and down the field for 1 hour with 5 minutes in between, it was deemed okay. Because our world decided it, and the men could care less whether we did or we didn't. But what it teaches us is the beginning of the realization of endurance. That women do, in fact, have endurance. And so we have happily played field hockey since 1901, when a grand old woman named Constance Appleby, who lived to 108, single and happy, brought the game to the United States, brought it to the women's colleges of the country. Why then can we play basketball our way and field hockey our way and eventually softball our way? Because it was a women's world, and it was determined by us what we did. Did the men care if we played softball? Did the men care if we played field hockey? Did they care if you played this silly game of basketball? No. And so it's clear that the separate sphere we live in does influence us. It made me a leader. I became a head of a department without knowing that I wasn't going to be able to be a head of the department once I decided on Title IX. So we have a catch-22 in our athletic world, as you people do in a lot of your worlds. When I say feminist, what's the first thing that anybody over 45 does? When I stand up and say, I am a feminist, what's your first kind of reaction a decade ago, say? Sammy, what would you say?
Well, I would have challenged you, I guess, and I'm not sure I would have been real, you know, you may have been kind of unapproachable. I would say more than 10, because I've been struggling with this for 10 years already. But I think you'd have been feared a little bit. It would have been a threat.
So it's okay if I stand here behind the desk and say this. But when I come out to all of you and say, I'm a feminist, then it has a sort of different tone to it. And that's the process of the softness of the woman, in which the aggressiveness is removed one or two steps back. And yet, who decided that this aggressiveness does not fit my pink? Other women first? No. That world over here of men, the sphere that we really didn't live in very much, is what suggested to you. What is there that made them suggest that? Which may, in fact, then get to some of the myths about women. Why would they be interested in me softly giving my answers? What are some of the things that I should be? Maybe better, what should I be? Or what should I have been?
Well, you should be a mother.
Well, first of all, a mother. Not even first of all. In order to be a mother.
Married person, yeah.
I've got to be married.
Barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen.
Barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen. But before all that happened, before marriage, what do I need to be?
You have to be non-attractive.
A dutiful daughter.
Attractive, dutiful daughter.
Well, I think, first of all, I want to say that gentleman over there is very pleased to have come. But you could have been a nurse or a teacher. I would have allowed you that.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm. I can have the service centered. Then maybe I could also be single.
Yeah,
if I'm going to be a teacher, mm-hmm. I'm going to be a nurse, a missionary I could be, although it's not very good to go running away. The Augustana Lutherans let you do that in Africa.
And if you do that, you're non-sexual.
Yeah.
If you go overseas as a single person, you know, at least that was the
right. That you surely have committed yourself and gone to the nunnery.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're a nurturer or a potential nurturer in all of those roles.
And all of those roles are nurturing roles. And so when we look at the past, we have to be a nurturing potential. But in order to get married, I need attractiveness.
Subordination.
Seductiveness, but very carefully, because I can't be aggressive in my seductiveness.
Because you need to be a virgin.
Because I certainly need to be a virgin. And so as you look at the past, you can see how your worlds were molded. Furthermore, starting in 1921, what probably is the most important activity for women in this country to demonstrate that they are of the texture for marriage? And I believe it was Washington, D.C., 1921, having nothing to do with our vote, having nothing to do with suffrage, having a lot to do with following the dictates of what man would like in woman. And I'll give you another clue. Early 1970s, there was an attempted boycott of this activity in Atlantic City.
New Jersey.
Yes, American.
Of course, beauty pageant, the first all-American beauty contest. From that day forward till today, the really achieving woman has moved into beauty, where female beauty doesn't ever equal female equality. And so it was a better dimension than barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen, and that is that I have this beautiful woman. But this beautiful woman was not only a part from 1921 on, but when you look at the Victorian world, what could woman do? She could be lady of leisure, look well, be submissive. What has she got? Taking care of her body, corset. And so if she sports, here she is in her sporting tradition.
If she wearing, Joanne?
She climbs, she is wearing a full-blown 21-pound dress and undergarment. And she is playing tennis. And she is playing tennis, according to the attire, about 1896. Here she is in a little better condition insofar as in the 20s now she is climbing. But she is climbing with 31 pounds we've gathered from my dress reform women in that effort. So imagine how good she is. She can carry your pack for you. And she gets rid of all this attire.
That's true in the 1890s of the upper class, but the women in the working class were out there working, you know, providing for their families.
We're not even into the working class. She's not there. The immigrant woman is not there. It's interesting that the immigrant woman can sweat, and she can raise her children, but what is she striving for? There's a book called Cheap Amusement on the working woman in New York City. Excellent book. And all of those immigrant women into between 1880 and 1920 are striving for better lipstick, better fingernail polish, a hat, some gloves, to go to the Nickelodeon, to go to the shows in which men are present, and primarily to go to the dance floor, so that they can move into the middle class and upper class. Unfortunately, most of what I can tell you is middle class and upper class until I get to the health of today. Because that's, if historians have written at all in their one sentences or two about us, it has to do with the middle class and upper class. But it's important as you think about what it is you want to do today that you realize that. Who decided that I can play tennis, archery, and from 1890 on, that I can ride a bicycle? Who decided all that? Did I, as an affluent wife in society?
Men allowed it.
Men allowed it. Why did they allow it? They allowed it because that's what they did that wasn't physical. Women in sport have been allowed, as it were, to have sex-appropriate sports based on what men did and what they were willing for women to do. Men wanted women to be able, originally, to ride the bicycle, to be out of doors. Perhaps the most important movement in our society really has to do with my bicycle shirt, because the dress reform is what began to free women in the 90s, in the colleges, in the universities, and at home. Originally, she went with her husband or her boyfriend. In some way, you didn't do anything naughty riding a bicycle. And you could go unchaperoned as early as the early 90s. And the dress reform is a direct result of the bicycle. By 1896, we are into the tandem bikes. Men now leave the bikes, except the middle lower class, because they're riding them to work. And so it becomes a workplace thing rather than an object of leisure. And you'll find women touring the country, having races, all the way from the 1890s. The American Wheel Men's Association took women in very early. They also took some blacks, by the way. And our very greatest black bicycler was in the 1860s, a guy named Taylor, Marshall Taylor, great. Almost as great as Isaac Murphy, the equestrian rider, who became a winner of the Kentucky Derby. Women, too, were equestrian riders and female jocks, riding jocks, jockeys, until they realized that the individual wasn't as important as a horse. And then the blacks left, and the women left, and the men became the jockeys until almost the present, as you see the historical unfolding. But in the sports, then, we can also do archery, because it's acceptable. Croquet, of course, from the 60s or 70s on. But as you look at our health practices, therefore, and the concept of beauty, all of this is done without sweating. Or if you sweat, or if you play basketball, you do it in the confines of the gymnasium. And you do it without you present. You simply can't be present watching us frolic around in the game of basketball. Until around 1905, anybody from Iowa? No Iowa. Good old Iowa girls went out and played before the spectators. And in fact, as late as 1975, I believe, or in the 60s and 70s, they made so much money on women's basketball in Iowa that one of the officers absconded with the funds. Now, that's a lot of funds to bother to do that. And it comes out of Iowa.
My grandmother taught me that ladies didn't sweat, ladies perspired.
Absolutely. Yeah. If anything, we certainly don't.
But you might be allowed a faint sheen on your forehead or cheek.
That's right. You certainly can do that, but what you certainly can't do is, if you do that, put a sweatband on. At least not until the tennis player. Martina put the sweatband on, and now you can put a sweatband on. And protect your eyes and being for the sport game. But you can see that tradition has sort of interfered. Also, in playing all of these sports we've mentioned so far, and the importance of gymnastics, meaning exercise, calisthenics and exercise, developed by Catherine Beecher from the Beecher family, the important temperance family. Catherine Beecher was a younger sister of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Her husband to be, or her fiance, died en route to England, and so she ended up single. And as a result of that, she devoted her entire life to teaching and for kinds of learning. And she was interested in women going to school. And education in the 1870s and 1880s, or 19, I mean 18, I'm sorry, 1870s, 1880s, was frowned upon for women. Why? What's wrong with education for women?
Makes them too equal.
Equal is not a good thing. Besides, look at all the nervous mental breakdowns you've had. I mean, throughout the ages, the women talk about all the mental breakdowns that they have had. So certainly, with the chance of nervous disorders, your brain, of course not equal, but even attempting to make it equal, interferes with the menstrual cycle, interferes with the possibility of children, and all of the things about physical education also then follow. So the early women leaders of physical movement moved into gymnastics. Catherine Beecher wrote a book that called Physiology for the Home and Family, which actually was used more by men eventually than by women. A great set of exercises which did not pull on your lower backs, which did not have too much flexibility, and the kinds of things that some of our women's exercises today interfere with. And so she is one of the early important leaders of getting gymnastics. And what it did was to help convince a man named Ken Clark, that those of you in education may know, wrote about the harm of education for women. And we're talking 1880s, and even into the 90s. G. Stanley Hall, the recapitulation theory, which is, and wrote a book called Adolescence. He was one of the prime educators in our country, and he said nix for higher education for women. So we're within only 100 years of acceptance of education beyond the eighth grade. Somehow or other, girls weren't groomed, fortunately, in our society, in colonial America, particularly by education. And so we were able to educate through the eighth grade, religious and non-religious schools were willing to do that. It was when you took that next move, first to high school, and then by a Kalamazoo Act, Michigan, by the way, in 1870, brought about the freedom for taxes for high school. But if you do it, you must do it for boys and for girls in the state of Michigan. And so Michigan was really one of the early leaders, although California was sort of already doing it on the high school. And by the Depression years, we probably have more women graduating from high school than we do boys or men, because they must go to the labor market. And the only way we could prevent that happening was the child labor laws. Which brings me to who dealt with the child labor laws? Who got them all passed? Women. Temperance Union, women. The bedrock of our social services, sanitation, education movements all came out of women. Volunteer organizations. And it's one of the important things you need to think about for right now. Because we have over half of the workforce females working, which means the other half are tending their children, almost exclusively young mothers, or women who are left for the volunteer ranks. And in your churches, you find that there's not too many of you left in the ranks. And it's one of the problems that the women movement didn't think about, just as they didn't think about bringing men along with them. They were so intent on their own revolution and reform that men were not a part of it, and the whole structure of volunteerism. But that's where the lady of leisure could put her time. That's where the affluent woman was freed. That's also where she learned bonding and networking, and all of it has almost been lost in the present surge, I think, of the women's movement or the feminist movement. We're willing to have feminist movements today in non-Christian circles, but somehow in our own churches we're not really bringing that to the forefront. But since it was the bedrock, we need to think about, do we want to bring some of our past that was great back? And I think that that's sort of one part of it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think another reason for not educating women was they wouldn't have time then for the family, and that they wouldn't be satisfied with just doing the household chores.
Yeah, but that's too far up front.
Uh-huh.
That was one of our second. Ken Clark wouldn't admit that. G. Stanley Hall. The women all knew it, and they talked about it, and they talked about ways that they could combine and raise their children.
Wasn't it also just the anatomy is destiny thing?
Biology is destiny.
Wasted on a woman, so why should you do schooling? Because ultimately you will be a wife and a mother.
And ought to be. And
yes,
better
you
be.
Must be. That's the only thing to be.
And so our whole concept of biology is destiny or anatomy is destiny made education look like too costly. Except, of course, you are the ones that are the moral fiber of the family. And as late as the 1900s, if your husband went astray, whose fault?
Yours.
You're the moral fiber of the family. You're putting the moral judgments into the children. And in fact, it's your responsibility. If your husband goes out and visits the prostitutes, then obviously there's something wrong with your family life. And so the woman who has no power in the upper structure of the churches held the responsibility of the boys and the males in the family. It's one of the reasons that sport became so important from the 1880s to 1920s for males. Because one, we're going to inculcate nationalism in you as a boy. Then we're going to inculcate character. That's how we build character in our boys, is through sport. Because they don't have to learn that at home if they don't want to. because that's from Mere Woman. And yet Mere Woman is the one that was supposed to teach all this. And so we're kind of caught in the whole process of the neighborhood movements, the playground movements, the park movements were developed originally for boys so that we can inculcate all of the values that they begin to miss in the church and that would develop into nationalism. At the same time, however, the Jane Addams neighborhood house variety said, girls need to play too. And so play was brought into the playground movements, but here are the boys with the playground, and here are the girls with the playground. And they were to be learning what?
Playhouse.
Playhouse. Then if they do have any sport in the play variety, the same sort of, to me, as an athlete or as a woman in sport and activity, any kind of physical activity, or even going to the workforce. What must I keep from my 1921 world?
Beauty.
Beauty and appearance. Beauty first. And so for a couple minutes, think about how important has beauty been in molding your own thinking about what is right, how you're going to raise your children. What is this separate sphere? Not so much necessarily for yourself, but in relation to others. What are some of the marks of beauty that women ought to have as they're going to survive? And what's kind of the underlying, what's the bottom line of who decides it? How do you know what is beautiful?
Kind of the fashion industry. You know, you need to be skinny, slender.
Ah, number one, slender. What's the problem with women being slender in the nutrition world that you know of?
Constant diet.
Constant diet. Is there a natural fat content of our body that says slenderness is not healthy? Right. Anybody know approximately how much body fat we ought to have as adolescents, for example?
At least 10%.
When you get to 9%, the menstrual cycle will most often cease. And in the past, we thought that wasn't important. We're beginning to know that it may be important, and it's definitely important in the hormones as you move towards adulthood. And because Scandinavians are prone to osteoporosis. Osteoporosis may be one of the damages we're doing to our young girls. We're just now finding out that we may need to be sure that the fat content of girls, for example, stay 11% for safety. How about for you?
You know, there's a bunch of things that that are attached to being sedentary. Very long flowing hair, which takes a lot of time to care for and isn't very convenient if you're trying to do athletic activity. All of the ways that fashion has pushed around.
Waistlines,
I have
hips, a wonderful picture someplace of a girl with her hair falling down trying to bat. And just then evidently the wind came this way. And so of course she strikes out. And her family, however, thought, why do they keep the long hair when it's so inconvenient?
Why do you suppose? It's romantic. I mean, it's the romantic image of woman.
And probably their boyfriends.
And it's always men who want long hair.
Men like long hair. It's like liking small feet of the Chinese, so we break them. Because then they can't work in the rice paddies. Therefore, they can be a candidate to move up in their society, to be useless. I mean, all of the effort that has been put into our society to make women useless. After all, one of the things it shows is how rich your husband is. I mean, even today you're fighting that inner, I'm not making as much money as my wife is, or if my wife works, how will it look? Even after the kids are, say, 5 to 9 and in school, and you could get a job where you could be home at 3, there's still that nagging that we encourage as women, because when I say to you, hello, how are you, and your husband works with me, but I, or around,
and I say, how are you? What do you do? And she says,
what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a physician assistant.
Okay. Immediately she says she's a physician assistant. If I go ask somebody who's not working, what do they say?
Just a housewife.
Or what's your other choice?
So-and-so's wife.
Right. Oh, I'm John Jones's wife. He's the dean of the College of Physical Education.
My job is to live with John Jones. Joanne. You should ask me what my husband is.
Right. And everybody says, what do they say when you say my husband's a nurse?
I look a little askance.
Oh, and you're the assistant? To the medical man?
PAs are men and nurses are women.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And who's going to be running the nurses' stations in the future? Men. Who's running PT right now, which was about 95% women? Men are becoming the heads of PT, physical therapy departments. Education, who's becoming in elementary, which was and still is 85% men? I mean women?
Principals are men.
Principals are men. If they're women, they are beautiful women. Or if you happen to be in a good school system, you maybe can't separate them by married and unmarried and looks.
Same thing's true in social work, which women started.
Right. All the service organizations, suddenly men are capable of dealing with them.
When we bought our first house, nearly all the real estate was handled by men, and that has totally, almost totally switched over to women. That's a field where women have really taken it over.
Right. And it's interesting that they can do that since they can't count money and they can't keep their checking accounts, but they know how to make $3,000 to $5,000 on the house that they're dealing with. That's one of the interesting professions that they're studying at our institution is what has permitted the real estate industry to encourage women. Some of it has to do with, well, it's okay, after all, that's where women spend all their time and ought to anyway, so that then they can tell you what are the best parts of this house. But when we get to the final thing, do you have a head man that can sort of talk business with my husband here in the real estate? Although women are holding their ground there probably as well as anywhere. Women are in many ways doing better in higher education. In my field, we're doing a lot worse because I was an administrator and could have been. Now, I probably still could have, but I wasn't willing to pay the price of going through the hoops to do that. Coaches, we're losing women coaches. Role models are consequently being lost because men obviously can do it better. It doesn't matter that they failed in coaching men, so they moved over to coach women.
There's more of them, too.
They still can. Yeah, and they talk about a shortage, but there really isn't a shortage. Track and field, there is a shortage because they haven't been. Gymnastics, there's a slight shortage, partly because the gymnastic kind of girl has, in the past, gone into the beauty kinds of post-gymnastics, as the female swimmers have, the ice skaters, the figure skaters have. Now you take a great and glorious gold medal winner that we have had in basketball, and those women are all still looking for a kind of position that would be middle management. And all of them could do it by virtue of having both to have been a team and been an individual. That's one of the things that I think is great for all children to be in sport, is because I do think it has some.
We recently had a life insurance agent talk with my husband and I about how much each of us was insured. And when he looked at how much my husband had a little bit more insurance than me on him. And he said, well, you know, if you were to die, speaking to me, he said, you know, your husband would really get a windfall. And I said, you know, in other words, he was trying to say, you know, your husband should have a lot more insurance on him than you. And I said, well, you know, if I was to die, do you know how much money it would cost for my husband to get somebody to come in here full-time and take care of our three children
And, you know, I went on and on about all the symptoms. Just went, oh, well, you know. And it totally amazed me that somebody that dealt in that field, you know, these days would feel that way and to make a comment like, you know, your husband really had a windfall. But, you know, I think he wished he hadn't said it after,
right? Except it was an educational experience, a teachable moment.
Yeah, and then I gave him an article I had clipped out of the newspaper that talked about the erosion of women's salary after childbearing, you know, how many years your salary had gone down and so forth. And so it was a good dial. It ended up being good, but it was interesting that he's a professional in his field and I thought was undereducated in that area.
I think there's still that belief that women can't possibly quite achieve the equal in terms of status and being, and the anatomy is still significant. Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking back to your examples of women identifying themselves through their husbands, and all of a sudden I remember about 10 years ago being in the company of about 15 seminary professor spouses, and we were each asked to identify ourselves, and it was just the time of a real struggle, you know, toward feminism in my own life too. And I think that this has just been stamped on my mind. Every single woman got up, she said her name, and then told everything that her husband did, what he taught at the seminary, where you know, everything about him. And one little woman got up and she said, I resent this. I mean, now this has been 10 years ago. She told about how she had started a business and that that was her own business, you know. And it was just fascinating to me how through their husbands they retained their identity too. What happens when these men die? And that's where you have a complete breakdown of personhood.
Or divorce.
Or divorce. Right,
divorce
exactly.
Even more. You have a little better group on a death.
Yes.
Even if, and particularly a young death, than you have in divorce. Divorce, it still goes back slightly to it's your fault. I mean, there may be two sides to the story.
There's guilt.
But it still has a lot to do with sort of your fault. And then the divorced woman has a whole new world that she has to deal with. Even educated women have a whole new kind of role where they have to say, I do this, and this is my life. But not that this is sort of in the next kind of world. The other thing that we need to talk about, I want to talk a little bit about hormones because it's terribly significant for all of you. Also, birth control. When's the first time you had birth control that you know of? Any historical kinds of backgrounds?
Oh, it goes back way, way
thousands and thousands of years.
Cleopatra, what did she use?
Probably a sponge or a condom.
Rubies. I mean, she didn't mess around. Rubies for...
Rubies.
Oh. Just like an inner uterus.
Oh. You mean a big
but that hurt?
Tell me more.
Yeah, but it's classy.
Maybe it was a rounded form. But certainly kinds of sponges.
Cervical caps and condoms were around for thousands of years.
Various kinds. The manufactured ones, we're talking 1927, 1928. Which is interesting that it sort of took that long, with the diaphragm being one of the early forms that the women used, with the responsibility then, of course, on the woman. The pills, the responsibility is on the woman. For only recently have we had vasectomies, where the responsibility moves to the man. And there's often some psychological problems. What I keep telling these men is, you should have played football, then you know you're a man forever. Because if football isn't the rite of passage vis-a-vis sport, I don't know what is. It's one of the reasons I think women have had problems in sport. But as long as we can keep football there to mangle them and to ruin their knees, then we probably have manliness. But it has been a question. The condo, of course, makes it the responsibility of both, but after all, it's not romantic.
Didn't Isn't that in the olden days when the man used to go off to war, put chastity boxes on the women?
Well, yeah, in that's where the chastity belt concept comes out of the Middle Ages. Also, when they went to fight in the Christian Crusades, and they needed to, because those men did have a wow of the time, as they moved. And that's why then, at home, the, what do they call the boys that were preparing to be knights?
Pages.
They were all responsible to keep you all happy, and you can go out hunting with them, and we'll take care of your handkerchief and take care of you as woman, so that you don't know really what I've done when I went to war, and really we didn't have anybody to go far enough. We already owned all the territory in the Middle Ages, so the chastity belt is the concept. And even in what's the modern show that it's the basis for Camelot? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Camelot's whole story is, you know, it's great love, but it comes out the same. they are in a win-loss sort of situation. So we've got it from sort of forever. But certainly the power of birth control has changed your lives. There is no question that the whole question of abstinence is not, or withdrawal, all of those are not essential. And this doesn't mean you're 100%. I have the story of the tiny baby that was born with his fist all clenched, and they were trying to pry those fingers open, and they finally got one hand open and everything was okay. They got the other hand open and the kid starts laughing. They assume that this kind of a newborn laughter, and in there is a birth control pill. And so
I thought it was an IUD.
Well, those are even worse, but we don't have 100%, particularly if there's a little forgetfulness in the world. But that whole change, I think, has freed men and women for deciding what kind of a family one would have and at what stage and at one time. And I think it's a very important freeing. The next whole question that, fortunately, we won't have time to deal with is abortion. And that's your problem, Mary.
I wanted to stop for a minute, because I think that one of the real big differences about health and birth control that you're discussing is that as long as women can choose whether or not we're going to be pregnant, it's not immediately visible to the world if you've been sexually active. I mean, there is a certain sense of escaping from being someone's property because, the risk if you were sexually active outside of marriage in the 12th century was very difficult, and you could be very readily caught and punished. And it wasn't really under your control whether you were going to be sexually active and with who.
Right.
The consequences were right there.
And even today, it has a tremendous effect on our youth, so that the youth in the nation up until AIDS had a new freedom of decision making. And as we talk about AIDS towards the end of the week, we can see that it's going to have another revolution within our society, where it's not going to be a question of morals or decision making for a night or even for 9 months or for a child. It's going to be a decision of a lifetime. And that is going to have a tremendous effect. And although it's primarily in the homosexual community, it has moved fastest in the heterosexual community. Now, more in the black community than in the white community. The largest gain of AIDS is in black males, and 52% of all babies born with AIDS are now black. And so the whole issue of black and the freedom of blacks, which goes back to your working class and how the working class world is a whole other world that Christine is going to talk about, I think, today in work and labor and those kinds of things. But certainly the whole revolution of birth control has affected our morals and our way of life and our decision making, and both freedom and some kinds of bondages. Some bondages to husbands
because the husband demands the birth control be taken care of by the woman, and all kinds of forms of abuse that move out of that is one of the things that Mary is talking about within our world. But as we look at health, I think that the prospect for the future in terms of removing our myths are great, and that your own study of health is terribly important. Your study of food intake and stopping to think about why am I on a diet? When for the teenage girl, she should have at least 11% fat, and we hadn't finished with what the adult female should have. Any woman past 40 can easily have from 29 to 33% fat and be a very healthy, happy human being if she lets herself be happy at that fat. From 34% up, then you may be carrying extra weight. What would you guess my fat content is?
15%.
I'm holding it in, gang.
Very low.
25%.
I was going to say 25.
Getting closer.
Yeah. 25 is still not it.
It's not it.
It's higher.
And it's not lower.
30?
Right on the button of 30. I had it done purposely for you. Actually, for me. But why do I look like I don't have 30% fat of my body?
Because you have muscles in tone.
My muscles are definitely in tune. There were a few that weren't about a week and a half ago when I climbed down White Pass. I mean, something happened to what I thought were great muscles in my thighs, but and my gastrocnemiuses, which are pretty hard. But I exercise 5 days a week, and all of you should be thinking of 4 days a week, at the very least 3 days a week, in terms of exercise, and stop worrying so much about your fat content. Unless you have been in a study recently, and I'm in lots of them because I'm over 50, and it's very difficult for our grad students to get subjects who are fit enough that they can take the test. Some of the tests are the stress test, for example. You women ought to be very careful about taking a stress test, by the way, without a good physician in attendance. And in fact, I had a whole subject of physicians I wanted to deal with that we won't have time for. But the physician does not know your body, and don't forget it, male or female, that you own your bodies. You know what your bodies are doing. They don't know what your bodies are doing. Be in touch enough with your bodies so that you can tell the physician. And don't let them say, it's just menopause. It's just emotional. When you have a change in your body, there's a reason. It may be emotional. There's about an 80% chance it's not emotional at its base. It may be emotional in death, in grief, but it still is a physiological change in your body that you have a right to figure out what it is. And in the world of heart disease and cancer, for example, you need to be constantly on the alert that those are the two most significant, with a third moving in more diabetes, more osteoporosis disorders, which we're now thinking comes out of our insistence that women do not take hormone therapy. Our studies are now showing that hormone therapy with both the estrogen and the progesterone are important, particularly immediately on the onset or even the thinking of the onset of the menopause. Because we now have been checking women's bodies. They are losing bone density fast. They're getting osteoporosis early. They're breaking their bones much more readily. And the skin disorders, and even in the health of the general skin is being affected because we have said hormone therapy may cause cancer. Hormone therapy is just a physician that wants you to do it.
And our studies are clearly showing, particularly if you happen to be very, very athletic, and so you had months and months without a menstrual cycle, or you happen to move up to Holden Village where every other month your menstrual cycle can easily not be a part of your cycle because you've changed in elevation. Any of those kinds of major changes between about 13 and 21 we're finding to be more significant than we had thought in the past, and therefore hormones are important. Furthermore, if you were sedentary as kids, then that's kind of the lowest in terms of having bone marrow, having bone density, and more chance of osteoporosis. So I suppose if you've had a sport, in a sense, in moderation, that that will help. But most of us, 40 and above, unless you were good, strong farmers' wives, or parents encourage sport for you equal to the boys, that the hormone therapy may in fact be important for you, and you need to check that. Just as they talk about having monograms once every 3 or 4 years, if you have any cancer in your family, we're finding if you can catch breast cancer, particularly singles, women without children are more susceptible to breast cancer and need to have the mammograms more often. And these are facts that particularly the Boston group of women who were those who wrote My Body, Myself originally suggested and still are halfway suggesting that hormones probably are not necessary. Calcium, yes. Even though calcium pills don't have the same content as calcium, that calcium will help. And calcium, even during the 35 and up, right now we're saying calcium. Sammy?
Yeah, that hormone intake, you know, that you say is so necessary, doesn't that depend on the person, though, or are you saying across the board?
We're almost saying across the board. If you've had good moderate exercises, you don't have osteoporosis in your family, you're not a Scandinavian, you can always have a bone density test. Now, it costs about $60, but it will tell you, perhaps.
And you're saying more for bone than for general well-being?
Well, general well-being, perhaps, but more for osteoporosis, more for the general well-being of the individual, I'm saying yes.
It really does.
And for less cancer. I mean, most cancers, no. Heart, definitely in terms of heart. One last thing, because it's time to go, is for young women, remember how important in pregnancy it is not to smoke, very little drinking, and caffeine. Particularly caffeine is what we are finding so destructive in young babies. So consequently, you need to think about that. Other thing no one has told you to think about is if you are a jogger, a strenuous jogger, think twice if you have any chance that you are pregnant. We're finding that the blood supply is being cut off to the fetus with very vigorous jogging in pregnancy. So that is a concern that we just are beginning to know about.
I was just going to say, doesn't an exercise like jogging on a regular basis keep that bone density?
Right. Well, it certainly helps. And I'm not saying everybody needs the hormones, but you definitely need the exercise, and walking is your very best. Swimming is very close to that. Swimming aerobics. Jumping kinds of exercises, think twice about, and if you're not sure about it, talk to me. We're trying to get less strong jogging and even some of the aerobics of women who were not active all their lives. If you're very active all your life, then it probably is not harm. But we're finding pelvis problems, knee problems occurring with too much jogging too late in life, where the bone marrow did not produce strong muscles and bones. Hmm.